Yes. That's this is the title they gave me. I'm not.
Okay.
I'm not. nothing to do with. I don't know why this title. People have already talked about this neutron star equation of state. I think that's the sort of beginning motivator for this kind of high frequency business. But I think there are these other interesting questions to look at, especially new neutron star equation of state is kind of a well plowed topic in terms of we know that's a thing to investigate, but with the fact that these days people who are working on the LHC commonly will say, well, of course I'm not going to work on that for the rest of my life, because they're starting to see like that's also not a desert, but you know what's coming out of there. And so we want to find some sort of new physics, and what's our possible directions for looking for this. Astronomy is basically the only game in town, unless it turns out we have super low energy wings of the high energy phenomenon showing up at the tabletop by atomic spectroscopy or something like that. But in some sense, gravitational waves is our new tool for doing tabletop spectroscopy, but out in space. So we have a few of these things, I think, that are interesting to look at. What we were talking about during the breakfast today is, do any of the BSM type effects in neutrons show up in neutron star equation of state or disruption? Did these super high energy phase transitions in the early universe, is it possible that they've redshifted down into the audio band, even in the, may not be 1 kilohertz, but up to 10 kilohertz or 100 kilohertz? And cosmic strings and vibrations, topological defects, these are all sorts of things that are probably not 100% of the dark matter, but anyway, who knows if it's possible to be a few percent. And then this is not exactly like a direct high frequency source, but it's a fact of having potentially, by the year 2040, we're going to have a space interferometer and be able to measure events down to the millihertz level. And if we can also measure things at 1 kilohertz and 10 kilohertz, that gives us 6 or 7 orders of magnitude in frequency space of looking at the phase, basically whether the phase of the inspiral is consistent. So if there's some really low mass things that don't have a merger until 1 kilohertz, or even if we have like basically macho type objects like subsolar mass black holes that go all the way to 10 kilohertz, we can observe the radiation over this long period of time and see if there's any anomalous dispersion in the space-time, whether it comes from something that looks like the graviton mass, or if it's some higher order dispersion relationship that basically amounts to what this paper is about, which is high frequency resonances in space-time, or the kinds of things we talked about during lunch, which is, is it possible, these days, if you look at what people are doing in the microwave background world, it's no longer just what's the temperature of the CMB or what's the what's the quantum fluctuations in the CMB, but it's a nice backlight which highlights the universe in the times of z less than 1,000. Basically, what happened in the universe, the CMB lights it up. And so we might think about gravitational waves as being not that interesting anymore. I mean, we got one or I forget exactly how many announcements LIGO has made, but we have less than 20 black holes. But let's say in the next 5 years, we're going to have thousands or so signals. And at some point, you're going to start to say, whatever, big deal. You detected a binary black hole. I have 1,000 binary black holes already. And there's a new thing which we could do, which is illuminate the nearby universe, meaning everything less than z of 0.1 or something like that. We can illuminate with gravitational waves and then look to see if there's some sort of anomalous interaction with the dark matter density that we've observed or something like that. So I think we should keep in mind that there's all this kind of stuff which has no real proof for it yet, but it's not been ruled out. It's a good thing to look at. So just to remind you, of course, there's this multi-decadal frequency space for gravitational waves. And then this, people show this often. It's a little erroneous. There's no such thing as a terrestrial interferometer at 1 hertz. that's never going to, it's just like Looney Tunes, never going to happen. People talk about it, but the people who talk about it, it's like, they're nuts. It's like if people who think we're going to have flying cars next year or something like that. It's just wild. The reality is these devices only work at from like 30 hertz and higher. And that's all that's ever going to happen. It's just too hard. But space interferometers potentially go all the way down. If the LISA space mission right now is like 1 million kilometers, which is big, that's this low frequency part. But potentially, you could have an AU-sized interferometer, which will get you down to microhertz. And then you can also make a smaller one of this, which extends up to here. So I think my point is, for terrestrial systems, there's no reason for us to basically compromise all of this high frequency part by engineering these things to work down here. Essentially, half the cost of these things, I mean, we plot it in the log space to make ourselves feel better, but half the money that goes into this thing is devoted for less than 20 hertz. And we have no signal from below 20 hertz. Just we're putting all of this effort into something that pays off very, very little. But you know, if we put that into the high frequency part, it would be dramatic. Dramatic what we could get. It would be like an order of magnitude at high frequencies to give up this little bit of low audio frequency stuff. So this is the blue and the red are actual history, and green is my prognostication. So this was the first bar, not bad. It looks like a small number, but in the end, we had to get to this 10 to the minus 21 or 22 level to have a detection. So this started off, there was 8 orders of magnitude before success. And so now I would say we're just beginning to maybe like, today is the first day where we really discuss how are we gonna do things at 5 kilohertz. And it may be that we're not within a factor of 2 yet. Hopefully it won't be this long, but maybe we're just 1 decade away from it. I think this is what I can imagine we would do. All of this stuff, the first few green stars, is the incremental improvements that we basically have in mind for the next 1 or 2 years. And this green one I'll tell you a little bit about. And this, to get to 10 to the minus 25, we're going to have to really employ all these exotic extraterrestrial technologies like super-duper quantum mumbo-jumbo that people talk about. Not just you, but other people talk. These are our current facilities. We have these LIGO things, which are okay, but they're now 20 years old and kind of decaying. And so we're considering, should we spend a lot of money to fix them or move to some new place? There's other new ones. The Italian one is sort of, not really new, but also 15 to 20 years old. GEO is more than 20 years old. Is GEO the oldest one?
It's about the same as LIGO.
All right, 20. And this is a sort of new one, like not even really born yet, Kagra, in the Kamioka mine. This is happening. I think this one has a good long-term prospect because it's built in a solid place. But it's unlikely that any of these ones or the LIGO one would be really, what do we want to have 20 years from now? It's not really, they're only designed to have a 20-year lifetime. At some point, it will be so much. It'll be all patches in order. If your roof starts to leak, you can put something in the roof to stop the leak. But then eventually, you've replaced the whole roof with just a bunch of patches, and then you don't want to do it anymore. And sometime before that, you should move. So this is our current situation and strain. We had this first signal, and this is the sensitivity. I think about a half a year ago or something like that. At the lowest frequencies, these longer detectors are doing good just because they're long and they spend a lot of money on the seismic isolation. But if you're looking at the high frequencies, you notice GEO is really not so far from Virgo at the highest frequencies here. And as Dan was mentioning, it's not so clear to me anyway that we can't get away with just having many, many 1 kilometer type systems. If we want to do neutron star physics or any of this high frequency stuff, the idea that you have to put everything in one isn't really making that much sense to me. If you want to have such a real broadband thing, you have to spend a lot of money and a lot of work. And by necessity, we're always compromising something here to improve something here. And it's not the best. It's not the best for most everything. It's the best for making the detections of, if you want to increase the number of neutron stars mergers that you detect, that's what you want to do, is broadband. But that's not really, I don't know, they exist. Who cares how many we detect anymore? The main thing is the SNR of the ones we detect. So there's this Indian one, which is happening. This is the new site, this yellow pin I put into Google Maps. These are some of the institutes who are now involved in working on it, at least on the experimental side. This one, we expect for it to wake, when it wakes up, will be a bit better than this blue one. So the goal is that fundamentally it could be a factor of two better or three better than this. So it'd be the newest, shiniest one. So I think we didn't yet go over these limits. What are the real limits of the interferometers? In a bit, I'm going to talk about this quantum thing, but just to give you an idea of the things which don't matter for us. For instance, when you think about the high frequencies, the seismic vibrations don't matter. And the real limit to getting to the low frequencies on the Earth is the fact that the gravity on the Earth is fluctuating due to whatever, plants and animals and cars and that sort of thing. So we can't get better than that. The two things that do bother us for the high frequencies are thermodynamic fluctuations, which don't really have a high frequency cutoff, and this thing, scintillations, basically the column density of the residual gas in the beam tubes changes, and so you can get some phase noise, just like a flat noise. But the real limit, the thing that we are designing for, is how to get rid of the quantum fluctuations. And so this curve shows you, this is strain on the y-axis, and x is frequency, the audio frequency. And well, here's the thing that maybe you didn't notice. When people show these, the frequency cuts off at just a few kilohertz, because everyone until, I would say like a few years ago, just said, well, there's nothing happening up here. Who cares? Let's not even concern ourselves. And neutron star merger physics, whatever. We would be so happy to detect any signals. Let's just optimize all of the numbers in our calculation to increase the number of our chance of finding a binary neutron star signal before our project is canceled. And that was the whole optimization made. And now we say, oh, well, they're easy to detect signals, but let's do something interesting. So now, of course, we're talking about this. But when the first detection happened, our noise was like this, and the black curve is what we had promised at the beginning and said LIGO will be like this. And there's a big gap here, factors of several and orders of magnitude down here, and factors of several over here. And it's improved a bit over time, but we're not there. This is the situation in October. October of 2016. And the main thing just to see here is that this plot has 6 or 7 traces, and then this one has a lot more, which is to say the previous one is just what you calculate on paper, and this is what happens if you measure what's happening. There's a lot of mess down here. And this mess is not because of just laziness or incompetence, but it just seems very hard. Everyone struggles and tries to remove these things and then eventually gets depressed and leaves and goes off to fancy faculty positions and stops doing important work. And so we're left with this stuff here. And up here, however, when this happens, people get old, for example, and they get tired of working on hard problems. They say, let's have a workshop on several kilohertz signals because there's no traces up here. All we have to do is fix one thing and it would get better. And well, I understand this kind of thing. So this seems tractable. Let's do it. It's easy to calculate. It's just quantum mechanics. Well.
Sorry, can you go back to the previous slide again? So this is the actual, now you're going all the way up to 10 kilohertz.
Is that right? Pretty close. This is just almost 8. Yeah.
So why is the slope of the black is a measured noise? So why is What is the blue curve?
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very boring, so I was trying to skip it. Do you really want to know?
Yeah.
All right. Unfortunately, here's the thing. So some people, when they talk about LIGO, it's one of these many myths that people tell you, that they say, well, the gravitational wave has this quadrupolar pattern, and so we were going to match it by having a interferometer, Michelson interferometer like this. Of course, that makes sense. Yeah, it's false. I mean, the only reason that this is done is because this is a differential measurement. And so at the beginning, we have the laser, and the real laser wavelength is some number, but it also has some variation. And this variation is just due to stochastic processes, that sort of thing. And if we balance these arms perfectly, this is kind of canceled in this signal. But it's imperfectly balanced. And so we have some residual coupling of this laser phase noise into the readout.
Okay.
And this is the best we've been able to do. We're a little bit, the whole thing is, we don't know why this is so big and from the laser side, and we also don't know why the coupling is so strong. It's a little bit anomalous at the factors of few level. And another one of those things, when people are young, they have the energy to like run around and work on these things, and then eventually they get tired, and this is what we got left. It's not fundamental, it's just kind of laziness, right?
I would say. You keep looking at him.
I do, this is all his fault. Yeah.
Sorry, so since you were talking about the high frequency side, so when we talk to continuous waves people, they were saying that the high frequency end has been calibrated for their group. Frequencies have
Oh, it's accurate. It's like they're complaining about 10% or something.
Okay.
It's not.
But up to whatever that is, 6 or 8 or something.
Yeah, yeah. But it's easy to do. It's just, if you took an afternoon, you could come visit and you could do it to whatever frequency you want. It's easy. It's,
I'm sure.
It's not that hard, you know. Yeah. No, none of these things are all that hard. You just gotta, like, a few people work on it for several months and it will get fixed. So I wanted to talk about the dirty problem of scattering, diffuse scattering in interferometers, because I think, I don't know, I just happen to be thinking about it this week, so I'm going to talk about it. So this is an image, if you look from the beam splitter of the interferometer here, and if you're looking toward the photodetector that we have, what's happening? And it should be, we're just sending the beam there, but clearly something is coming back the wrong way. And you don't want light to be going this direction. The light should be going this direction. So anyway, it's happening. And the reason is we have just got a lot of things where we shouldn't. This is a mirror, but it's surrounded by a bunch of metal. And then there's some more metal. And all of the metal is shiny, and it's scattering back. And why is it happening? Or where is this light coming from? This is a picture of the metrology of one of the mirrors. One of the end mirrors like this. And so the curvature has been removed. And then this is the shape. And it's in units of nanometers. So there's something like, I don't know, whatever you want to call this weird orange peel kind of pattern at the level of a couple of nanometers. And if you look at it, the power spectrum of this thing, this is something like, this is a spatial scale of 1 centimeter. And this is a spatial scale of 1 millimeter. So there's a lot of low frequency, long wave fluctuation. But if you have a long wave fluctuation, that should preferentially scatter into some sort of small angles. But then what you expect if you look at something that has only long wave fluctuations, it still should look like a pretty much a nice, shiny surface. It looks very specular. You don't see a lot of diffuse stuff. If I shine this beam on the wall, you can see it. Even though there's no direct reflection into your face, it's just diffuse radiation all over the place because the wall is rough at the microscopic level. But if I point this at, maybe I can shoot the video camera and stop them from spying on me. But you see it's sort of shiny.
People watching.
Yeah. So those, yeah. That reflection, it's specular. I know. It's a specular, but it's because the surface roughness is much less. And we expect our mirrors to be perfectly flat, not to have a lot of this high frequency stuff. And this is actually very good. In fact, it's almost all the energies at the long scales. But when we look at it really, this is what the picture looks like. It's illuminated by the laser beam, which is infrared. But if you just use your phone and take a picture of it, the infrared light shows up as purple. So all these purple dots, this is like looking at the mirror at a 45-degree angle. And you should not see this kind of diffuse scattering. But it's in fact, it's there. And what is all this stuff? And where does it come from? Not sure. We have this. This is like the Fermi's golden rule for scattering from atoms can be applied to optical scattering, which is you come in with a wave, and if you have some defect in the mirror like this, the probability of scattering into some angle is equal to the probability of light coming back along that path and scattering back into the main circulating optical mode of the system. And so that tells us if you come in with a laser beam, you'll have this not diffuse, but basically a bunch of points scattering into all directions. And now if the thing that the light hits is vibrating, that light will get back into your system by this time-symmetric thing, and it'll produce phase modulation on these light fields in the system, and that phase modulation will show up at your detector. And so this, even though we've spent all this money to put everything in vacuum, in fact, because of these points, we have an anomalous coupling to the environment we didn't want. And all right, that's not good. Anyway, you can calculate some things about these. So I made a simulation and said, let's say this is the mirror, and this is sort of the size of the beam. And here is a bunch of dots I put on here. What would happen? Well, you look in the far field, like 4 kilometers away, and there would be some sort of random radiation like this, mainly peaked at small angles, which to me was the surprise. It shouldn't be surprising, but the idea is this. If you take a Gaussian beam and shoot something like this, each of these dots radiates according to the Babinet's principle and gives you a spherical wave. And you can just do the Huygens integral for each of the dots and consider what's the far field radiation pattern. And it's just a usual phased array type of calculation. And it turns out if you have a random distribution of these things, both in position and size, generically speaking, whatever you do, you'll have something which is peaked at small angles. It won't be this diffuse thing that I'm doing. And the reason is this thing, the radiation from each of the points that it's hitting, they're not really phased up in any kind of way. They're not really coherently radiating. Whereas in this case, for the LIGO mirrors, each of the points is really well stabilized and being illuminated by a coherent wave. And so this is the 2D pattern. So 4 kilometers away, this is the size of the mirror. And this interference is happening right in the middle. But then there's also all of this stuff in all directions, which doesn't seem to have any azimuthal symmetry. There's just no symmetry. It's just sort of random outside of this very small angle. But the power in these wide angles is significant. Yes, why am I telling you about this? This is a foreshadowing. It's going to be very important. So we want to lower this photon shot noise thing, and we think that the way to do it is by using squeeze states of light. We basically have two options. For photon shot noise, you can increase the number of photons, and then your signal goes up like n, number of photons, and the fluctuations goes like the square root of n, and so the overall signal-to-noise ratio is like square root of 1 over the square root of n. That's the usual brute force approach, and we have a lot of problems of just increasing laser power, and we hear about it in a few more talks in this workshop. One of the options is to use the squeeze light idea. And why? Well, I think you've seen this before. The better we do here, we can discriminate among models, for example. So what's the squeezing idea? Graphically, this is it. We have a wave we're trying to measure, let's say the electric field. And there's a random noise on the electric field. And this comes from the injection of the quantum vacuum. So this is the interferometer. And instead of the squeeze light box, let's say I'm not doing anything, then the field propagating in this direction is the signal from the interferometer, but there's nothing propagating back in this direction. So this, in some sense, this is just the ground state of the electromagnetic field. And the ground state has the characteristic fluctuations of the ground state. And if you do nothing, it's just a sort of uncorrelated amplitude and phase fluctuations. And so you see this fuzz on this sine wave, which is to say, if I try to measure the phase of this, the strain in these two arms, I would have equal uncertainty whether I try to measure the phase, basically around the zero crossings, or the amplitude. It's equally distributed. What we'd like to do instead, we know we have to conserve total uncertainty. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle tells us. But what it tells us is we have to constrain the product of phase and amplitude noise, but not just phase noise by itself. And so that's what this picture shows. If there's a way we could somehow do it, we can squeeze all of the uncertainty out of the phase here and put it all into the amplitude. And for a sine wave like this, it's still very easy for us to estimate the phase. And it's hard to estimate the amplitude, but we don't really care because the gravitational wave puts most of its influence into the phase of the light, not the amplitude. That's the concept. Haixing Miao, who's one of the invisible conference organizers here, he was denied entry into Canada because he didn't have a visa, of course. I mean, that makes it sound like it's Canada's fault. He was denied because, I don't know, who knows? He's thinking about science all the time. But I'm basically repeating to you stuff that I learned from him over the past few years. And so it's this, the gravitational wave, well, yes. Based on what Haixing told me, but then I've exaggerated it somewhat. So this is my own take. But the gravitational wave has basically no noise. If we assume that space has these Planck scale fluctuations, I don't know if it does, but let's say, then the signal to noise ratio of the signal when it gets to the Earth is 10 to the 13, roughly. If you think about displacements over the scale of kilometers, you have the ratio of the strain in LIGO divided by the Planck scale fluctuation. So that's huge. Most of the signals we've reported have a signal to noise ratio of less than 30. So there's a big difference between this number and that. We should find out what it is. I've told you about these things, laser noise and so on, and mostly they can be fixed with enough work. And photon shot noise isn't fundamental. It's not like lasers all have, they're born with shot noise or something like that. The shot noise that we measure has to do with the interference between the field that we're using and the environment or the vacuum fluctuations. And then this thing, the center of mass fluctuations of a 40 kilogram mass, is orders of magnitude below the what we're talking about. So there's this paper where we talked about what's happening. Isn't this nice? This is like this is gravitational waves, and then I'm waving this thing. It's a very dynamic illustration. We said let's model this system, and what's the limitation here? So this is the concept that you have the very low noise system, which we treat quantum mechanically. You need the interferometer. We say the gravitation wave is a classical force. And what's the input-output relation? Well, basically, the wave does something to the field inside of here, which we detect. And then the vacuum field goes inside of the device, rolls around for a while, and also comes out. And those are the only two inputs, gravitational waves and the vacuum. And this, we treat the laser as a noiseless static field. And you may ask, why doesn't the vacuum matter on this symmetric side? That's reasonable. Any fluctuations on this side differentially go to these two sides and then come back out, basically unmodified. So at the highest frequencies, they're not resonant in these cavities, so it's just, this interferometer looks like a mirror. The fields just come right back out. And at the low frequencies where it is resonant in the system, the vacuum fluctuations enter the cavity, produce fluctuations in the field, and then come back out again. So those are the two ways the vacuum can interact. So this is the strategy, but this is the strategy I like to think about for how we will do the squeezing different from how we're doing it now. So now the strategy is basically this nice image. Squeeze light goes in, modifies, you put this in instead of the vacuum, and then you measure something sub-shot noise. In this diagram instead, we're using the idea of classical feedback to modify the quantum statistics of the signal that we detect. So it goes like this. The vacuum enters as usual. And here it can drive some funny shape, but you can also just think about it as driving directly the full center of the mass of the system. So the vacuum fluctuation is modified by whatever the fluctuation of the mirror is. And then that phase and amplitude fluctuation gets multiplied by the pump field, which in this case is the static laser field in the system, and produces whatever the beat note of that is. That beat note then is able to, you take the modulus squared of the field, you get the power, and then that tells you the force. And the force can either be uniform, or you can have some spatial pattern like this, which hopefully we will talk about soon. But let's assume that this is the lower order fluctuation at first. This radiation pressure just drives the mirror. Now, if your system is detuned in this way, that you're not quite on the resonance of the cavity, this mirror motion will give you a change in the amplitude of the field. So if you have a modification of the amplitude of the field, it produces a fluctuation in the phase by this way, directly by the mirror response. And then if you have a change in either the phase of the field or the motion of the mirror, it directly modifies the amplitude. And so you have this mixing now between phase and amplitude. And that is basically that's the secret sauce. In some sense, when you think about any kind of modification of the quantum statistics, you have to have this interchange between the amplitude and phase fluctuations in the field. This is one way to just do it optomechanically. And you don't really get it for free, but it just exists. If you build a system which has these properties, meaning it's not exactly at the peak of a Lorentzian, and the mirrors have a finite mass, this has to be happening at some level. And so this is just a matter of engineering the variables in your system so you can get this squeezed ellipse. So usually we have this uncertainty equal in both amplitude and phase. And this diagram is just saying if you have a resonant system like this and you look inside of it, what you'll find is that in general, you'll have an ellipse, and then the rotation of the ellipse will not be aligned with either the amplitude or the phase, but some admixture of those two. And then it's just up to you to exploit this natural phenomenon which goes on.
So this is for the mirror?
This is for the electric field.
Oh, okay. Sure. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
It is interesting, though, what you're saying. There is a complementary effect on the mirror. So
yeah, but for the mirror, because you talk about mirror response there, and got confused because the mirror should be treated classically, I would imagine. So big.
No, it's not. It doesn't have to be. So the center of mass degree of freedom of the mirror is not necessarily. It would be treated classically if it was well coupled to the thermal heat bath, and then you're fully exchanging with all of the modes of the system.
Yeah.
Right? In our systems, the reason we pick these type of mirrors is because the mechanical Q is so high. It's like 1 billion. So it means the equilibrium time from this mode to that mode is really, really long. So it's not decoupled, but it's not strongly coupled either. And
I mean, still, though, it's kind of hard to imagine that you have this 40 kilogram object being.
I know. Science is cool.
I mean, for example, to localize the state, let's say you're measured to the position of the mirror, all you need is a scattering of a photon from the wall to localize the state. So are you using states that are...
Not yet. It's our ambition to, eventually...
A
It's sort of like a side project to the LIGO. Because,
no, I would imagine.
But we think it's.
It's possible. That's the thing.
Yeah. I think it's possible, but we haven't done it yet.
How would you do that? For light, I can imagine that's the case. But
let me come back at the end.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I have to think for a few minutes while I'm talking. Okay. So anyway, we want to do the experiment for the E field. So this is our lab. These are people. This is the lab. Sorry. This is the lab. These are the people. And the concept is the same as the LIGO. We found, I think, like back in 2004 or 2005, in fact, we almost had this, and we just didn't know that it was happening because we didn't know how to think about these things. We do have the same scattering problem there, but I don't know if you can tell. It's much less bad than the other picture we showed you. And it's because here we're able to wipe some rags on the mirrors more often, because this is not LIGO, it's just some thing we have. So we just keep cleaning it. And it became very clean recently. And so we thought, what can we do? It turns out if we detune it into the state we had 10 or 15 years ago, we would get this sort of factor of a few squeezing internally. I think it's interesting to do just as a demonstration. So this is the contour plot of it. So this is in frequency, and this is something like what, on that ellipse, what angle do we read out? So it means we have to be sort of precise in the angle, but we should be able to get, this is in dBs, so this whole purple region is a factor of 2. So it means not really on the tabletop, but on a 40 meter scale with existing equipment, we should be able to see a factor of 2 with something like 1 year of work, I think. Okay, I meant to only talk for 30 minutes, but I'll just conclude, I think, because people may wonder about the cryogenics thing. So in LIGO, we have scheduled basically to do room temperature operation for a few more years, and then do a very minor upgrade of the room temperature system to put in a bit better squeezing and better mirrors, nothing major. And then hopefully 6 to 7 years from now, a more substantial upgrade where we replace basically all the optics in the system, all the lasers, all these things. And we would change from a system where we have these mirrors of 40 kilograms at room temperature made of glass to silicon 200 kilograms and 123 Kelvin, which happens to be a particularly low noise temperature for silicon. So we do this upgrade, and what would we get? Mainly we were designing this at the time when there were no binary neutron stars. It was all black holes. And so I thought we should sacrifice this whole high frequency part and emphasize here, because all of the black hole mergers and quasi-normal modes were below 500 Hertz at the time. So I think there we would have done pretty well. It would be like a factor of 4 or 5 better than the best advanced LIGO, and something like 10 times better than the current advanced LIGO, something like that. So it would be very good, but not so good for this workshop, unfortunately. And that design would have had a nice range. We would be able to see binary black holes to a redshift of several, I think, which is nice to be able to do in our lifetimes. Today, I would have better plots, but the SSH wasn't working on the Wi-Fi here, so I couldn't get the latest.
It's working.
All right. Well, anyway, because of this SSH, I'm showing you these substandard results. But I thought, let's change some things, and what can we do to optimize the high frequency part? Is similar to what I showed you before. It's a cryogenic type of thing. This is the best we could get with the LIGO. This is LIGO plus the squeezing. And this purple thing ends up being, it's almost an order of magnitude better than the advanced LIGO design in this region from a couple of kilohertz and up. And I think it's not too challenging. This is something like we changed the reflectivity, basically the coating design of several of the mirrors, like 3 or 4 of the mirrors.
Why is it so flat between 100 there and 1,000?
I'm very clever.
That we know. Not so clever.
Yeah. Well, it's this objection I made in the morning. I was saying, hey, why do we have this signal recycling and all this business? And that gives you a system where you take, I think it wasn't said, but this is the idea of this so-called signal recycling mirror. It's not a signal recycling mirror. It's just a thing that we say so that no one can understand what we're doing. This cavity has a resonance, you know, the line width is something like 50 hertz or 100 hertz or something like this. But yet you're used to seeing this kind of curve in the LIGO, which has it turns up at 400 hertz. What that means is the shot noise is flat. It's just a white noise. But the signal gain for the gravitational waves is going down like 1 over F outside of the cavity bandwidth. So that's why the sensitivity to strain is getting worse. And so the way that people make it better in some sense is put this mirror here, and this thing resonates with this one. And once these two resonate from this side for the field, because these two are resonant, the transmission in this direction becomes larger because it's a resonator. And so right at the peak, it's letting everything through. And so we operate it in that resonant way, and that broadens the system. So we narrow the bandwidth by making this thing very narrow and put all the power here. And then we make it, if you have a differential fluctuation, you get this broadening. So in the differential mode, the signal is broadened in some sense. So I thought, let's just make it extremely broad. So this one is made just extremely broad. And it's basically, there's almost no signal recycling type action going on. It's almost all, it's very, very broad. It sacrifices all this intermediate frequency business, but this is too bad. Of course, you'd like to have that too. But if the goal, you say, is like, let's say 1 year or 2 years, we're just going to study neutron stars, then let's do it. Instead of just, it's much better to have 10 times better sensitivity for a year than to go along with a factor of 2 for 10 years or something like that. We just spend a few years, get all the neutron star signals, and then get back to the black hole business. Once we have 1,000 neutron star mergers, we'll be satisfied, I guess. So this is a few tricks for the experts. I've assumed that we've injected 20 dB of squeezing, which is, it's not really what we can achieve today, or maybe even 5 years from now. It's like...
Inject or detect?
Inject. Yeah, it's doable, I think. It's just, today we have 12 or 13 dB, right? And 20 is some work.
15.
Yeah.
Sorry, do you have a candidate coding? I thought that was...
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Codings, yeah.
Codings. Well, you have codings on the mirrors now. I mean,
yeah, but
stuff you would...
No, I have the best coding ideas you've ever seen. Yeah, don't worry. The codings, that's the whole point, basically, of this design, is that this is operated at this temperature of 123 Kelvin because... at this low temperature, you can use a different kind of mirror coating than the standard room temperature type things.
Oh.
You can use semiconductor materials. And the semiconductor materials happen to have almost no internal mechanical friction at this low temperature. And because of, basically, if you have no mechanical friction, it means you're decoupled from the thermodynamic heat bath. And so the fluctuations from the heat bath don't get into the mirror surface. It's like having a system in space, basically. It's almost like a single eigenmode system.
The other question, sometimes, I guess I've asked some other people about this, but you may have a more direct answer to this question. So sometimes people draw this resonant pulsar. This
thing. Yeah.
So.
No. Those are the crazy people. No.
So that's completely out of the question? Or?
No, it's a, we have to have some calibrated difficulty scale. So mathematically, these things are all possible. And then you just have to say, like, how many people for how many years would you have to put into it?
Yeah.
And it was there a little bit. So Do you see this hair, this guy? So when I first moved to Caltech, he was a sort of a senior grad student there. And our project was kind of like what you're talking about. They said, work on this in this lab, and you should make this complicated system work so that you can change this high frequency dip and move it around a little bit. And at the end of it, he looked like this. He was just kind of all the time.
It's dude stuck.
It's just, yeah. It's technically, I think it's all still possible, but we found it technically challenging. It's just a lot of mess of electronics. And this thing that I showed you about the noise, this gets more complicated. And you have to have like four or five more plots on here in order to have that high frequency dip. So I wouldn't say we reject it, because some of this kind of thing that I'm talking about may end up using, it may turn out that we have to do something like that to really go deep sub-quantum. Yeah, so back to the foreshadowing. I think this thing, it says 20 dB, and then also this thing, basically, when this feedback loop is going on, what's going on is that you have, at a single frequency, or whatever frequency this feedback is valid at, you have a negative feedback for the phase fluctuations, so it cancels that, like the temperature control system here is supposed to cancel the temperature fluctuations. But because of this conservation of the Heisenberg uncertainty, that consequently also amplifies this, so you have a positive feedback making noisy the other degree of freedom. In order to have this kind of high amount of entanglement of the light, it means that when you keep going around the feedback loop, your photons stay, they're not lost, they don't scatter off into the vacuum system or something. And for that to happen, this this effect has to be reduced quite a bit. You can't have all this scattering into many directions. So I think the key is going to be this lambda. When we look at this, how much the power leaves, on the numerator, the sigma is the roughness of the system, which is the integral, this red line. It's the integral of this power spectrum. And lambda is the laser wavelength. So this laser is about 450 or 460 nanometers. And at the current LIGO, we're using a 1 micron for the laser wavelength. So I think we should go to 2 micron lasers, which are consistent with semiconductor systems and also consistent with having low loss. So I think those things will all go together. This cryogenic operation will let us have low coding noise. The long wavelength will let us have high coherence in the optical system. And we won't have some of these, I would say, nuisance losses in the system. So it will allow us to solve the quantum problem, I think, which is the high frequency shot noise. So this is, I think, what the outlook looks like for us. For the next 10 to 15 years, we're basically looking at all terrestrial systems. But by 2025 to 2030, we should be in this regime where we have a network of 5 detectors, not necessarily all LIGO, but anyway, 5 detectors, Virgo, Kagra, and the 3 LIGOs, 2 in the US and 1 in India. And I hope at least the 3 of the LIGOs will be, as I described to you, cryogenically. The Japanese Kagra is also cryogenic and perhaps can be modified like this, and maybe not for Virgo, I'm not sure. But then the long-term outlook is like this. We should have a few of these ultra-long systems, maybe not 40 kilometers, maybe 20 is a good thing. The LISA is still the year 2034, which sounds super futuristic, but anyway. And then this, you may have not have heard of Tiango, which is it's just a name I'm trying out. But Tiango, I don't know. It sounds a little bit like Tango.
The Tarantino movie.
Yeah, like Django. Yeah.
Exactly. It sounds like Django. It sounds like Tango.
But
It means a sky gravitational wave observatory.
What is that?
Tian is Chinese.
Oh.
Yeah. So they are not yet in the gravitational wave game, but they will be. I mean, everyone should be. So this could be one. But,
yeah, but is
Tiango,
it terrestrial-based? Is it Earth-based? Is it space-based?
Yeah. Tiango is the... is it bridges the gap. So Tiango...
Yeah, Tian is sky in Chinese.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you're confirming. Yeah, okay. Yeah, Tiango goes here. So the point of the Tiango is it lets the Earth-based systems go to high frequency, which as is natural, and allows the LISA to be concentrated at millihertz, which is natural. But it means that you'll be able to do this multi-band, multi-decade band gravitational wave, what do you call it? It's like spectroscopy of space-time. It's, you would just be, have gravitational waves over 6 decades in frequency, and you'll be able to measure like what's the real structure of the space-time that they're illuminating. So, yeah, it's, I think, very promising. And then none of these things are, I don't know what to say. Like on the, when I think about all the hard problems that we've already faced, none of the things I'm talking to you about are like level 9 hard. They're like any old grad student can just come and work on them. Yes. Thanks. Let's...